Welcome to the Future of Podcasts, where I deep dive into discussions with remarkable founders and industry experts, and together we explore the challenges of today and how they are innovating through them to shape a brighter tomorrow. In today's conversation, I'm joined with Peter Davis, co-founder and CEO of One Future Sports, which has started with one of the first global virtual football leagues with live games, fantasy league, killer kits, celebrity ambassadors, and fan control and ownership like you've never seen before. Peter is a multi-time founder, mentor to tech startups, a chairman of the board of directors for multiple foundations, raising millions of dollars every year to support the best and most innovative charities tackling challenges around women's mental health. I could go on, but suffice to say, a very impressive and admirable history. In this episode, we discuss the next generation of fans and fandom, what quote-unquote real engagement means, the commercial opportunities and markets this opens up, the role of AI personalities into the future, agility of business in the age of AI, ethical AI and innovation, inclusion and representation, integrity and building systems that fans can trust, among other things. So some very interesting topics with insights from a very fascinating person. And with that, I'm excited to present to you Peter Davis, co-founder and CEO, One Future Sports.
Peter, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
I'm excited for this conversation. I've done a bit of research. I know what you guys do, but I'd love to learn so much more. So one of the first virtual football leagues globally, my first question is, why should we care?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I think maybe it's depends on how old you are, you should say whether you should care or not at all, right? I think there's, for the trends that we're seeing, lots of younger people want to consume sports in entirely new ways, and that's what the research is showing, and that's what all the leagues are telling us, and all the sports around the world are struggling with this whole how do we connect with Gen Z thing. Maybe if you're happy with how you consume sports, then from your own personal consumption perspective, it doesn't need to affect your life at all. Maybe we're just designing this and it doesn't matter to you that kids are playing a virtual world in Roblox and Fortnite and Minecraft and those kind of things. Might not affect you at all. But I think what we're doing is we're already impacting the sports world. And so our virtual players are getting sponsored and that's taking money away from existing athletes. I'm sure you're not playing too hard a violin there to worry about all these athletes losing out on a few thousand dollars here or there. But I think it's coming, and I think it's, you might want to care because it's fascinating. It's just a lot of fun.
On that point, that new generation of fans, I was hoping you can kind of dig into that as well, because I understand, and you mentioned a few examples of, you know, the world of Roblox, etc., gaming. There's kind of different personas we're talking about here and different ways, you know, fans want to engage, and the whole realm of fandom evolving. So wondering if you can give a bit more insight around that. I know that fans can now own parts of the players, train them. So really evolving the way they interact and feel they're a part of the team or even player.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think, go back, so I'm just turned 40. And, you know, when I was 9 years old, I'd run around in my back garden and kick footballs around and pretend I was... I support Norwich City, so that's my team. I grew up there. That's the only reason why you ever support Norwich City. But I'd run around and recreate goals scored by Darren Eady and Chris Sutton and people that you would probably, most people have never heard much about. That was the experience I had with football at the time. We were much less of a connected world, and technology does amazing things and does terrible things. And I think that one of the things that, you know, parents and kids are dealing with now is the availability of connection, the availability of the way that young people get to engage with each other, with media, with content. You know, we used to get up at as early as we could on a Sunday morning because that our parents would let us watch TV, whatever we wanted on a Sunday morning, because that's when the cartoons were on. Our kids don't have those concepts anymore. Like, the world doesn't exist in that way.
Yeah, right.
So it's not about, I think that the whole experience of how people consume media has just dramatically changed over probably 20 years. And so people want involvement. They want to be able to pick things up and play with them. And it's no longer that that younger generation wants that like full lean back experience. Now, I've got 9-year-old twin girls, and anyone with kids around that kind of age will know that there's a battle of they just want to play Roblox. They would rather play Roblox than go outside and play football. They would rather play Roblox, or they'd rather play video games. They'd rather do, like, they want to live in that virtual world. And it's, I think it's trying to make that something that works for them as young people, works for society as general, you know, like in general, and gives us something really interesting. So One Future Football and One Future Sports as a wider business is that. It's about trying to look at how young people want to engage with sport and creating whole new ways for them to consume things, because they don't just want that lean back experience that we all grew up with where you watch what happens, single screen experience, your eyes are fixed to it. No one's doing that anymore. So It's about shaping something around that.
And just in terms of, I'm really interested to pick apart your insights in, let's say, those cohorts of audience.
Yeah.
Because historically, you've got one type of fan. But now, considering the platform, the emergence of technology, and different ways to engage, are we seeing a different, more of a cohort of like gamers, like strategists? Because I know training players and stuff like that.
Mm.
So I'm interested in your thoughts on how that's evolving. It's changing the way, again, just opening new markets and new kind of fans.
Yeah, great question. So how we see it is, in One Future Football, we created ways for fans to, again, like I said, not just be the lean back kind of model. I think in sports right now, there's two models. One is you could be a Manchester United fan and you could watch their matches on TV. You lean back, you have nothing to do with the team. You can't pick the team. You can't influence players. It's like watching a movie. You're very much the consumer who's being served up a product. You might hate how it is at the moment. You might love how it is at the moment. You might be somewhere in between. That's one kind of type of sports experience at the moment. The other is the far end of the scale, which is the gaming side of things. So it's people who play Football Manager. It's people who play EAFC.
Yeah.
It's people who, you know, played all the way through the FIFA games that we played growing up, like through the development of the new gaming engines and new rendering and those things. So there's two extremes there. One is you have absolutely no control whatsoever. You are a consumer. The other end, you have complete control. You control everything, but it's a singular person experience. Yep, you might have a friend who comes over. You might game with someone else on the other side of the world, but it's you guys in a closed box doing what you're doing. What we've created is something kind of in the middle, which is a shared experience that everyone sees these results, everyone knows these teams, everyone sees the players, and you get to be involved in different ways into that. So you get to own parts of players, you get to train them, you get to help develop them. But you develop that player alongside another fan in New York City, another fan in Manila, and another fan in Lagos, another fan in Manchester, England. And so you collectively work together to say, let's train the player on this thing, let's do this, so the player can get better, what if we do these things? You get to influence the manager, you get to have involvement in those pieces, you get to win when the players win, you get to unlock collectibles when they do things and score goals and score hat tricks and get player of the match awards and those kind of things. So for us, it's about that middle point. So again, far end of the extremes is Manchester United on one end, me playing EAFC in my bedroom with my brother on the other end. This is in the middle. This is a shared social experience that gives people the opportunity to kind of collaborate around it and share in the opportunity to win and lose together.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And do you see like the fans coming together per match? So like, hey guys, we're facing, you know, team XYZ. We really need to train our goalie up because this striker's crazy, or we need to train our midfielder because, do you see that level of engagement?
Exactly.
Oh wow.
Yes.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and the great thing about it, I think, is that, you know, there are a lot of different levers that we're trying to pull here, and we'll work out which are the big ones that really matter in the long run.
Mm.
But one example is, so One Future Football is the first sport that we've launched. We've got 12 teams around the world. And so we haven't just mapped those to the big cities of football now. We haven't got teams in just kind of Manchester, London, maybe Birmingham, Milan, Rome, Barcelona, Madrid. We haven't just said, let's just have teams there. We've said kind of the other way. It's like, how do you create a truly global league? Because, you know, maybe I'm just a believer in this, right? But football is the global language. If you take a football anywhere, you could have a kick around. You go to San Francisco and you can play under the freeway with a bunch of Puerto Ricans like I did when I lived over there. You can go to Gothenburg and you'll take a football, you'll play, right? It's the global language. Everyone loves football all around the world. Real loose statement, right? But it's a global language. But in the same way, there's lots of parts of the world that are then massively underrepresented at the top level of football. Fandom is as strong, but they get called plastics because, well, if you grew up in India, you have to pick teams that maybe would feel like you're picking a team just because it's a kind of glory pick. Mm. Again, no one's picking Norwich City from India because why would you? Mm. If you grew up in India, you're probably, there's a domestic league there in your Super League, which is decent, but you want to watch the top level of football. So you'll pick Barcelona or Real Madrid or Manchester City or Chelsea or Arsenal, whoever it might be. You'll pick those teams because you want to have that experience. You want to watch Champions League and watch your team running around in those places. So what we're doing is giving them an opportunity to have teams that they can have in a competition to compete at the top level. And almost more importantly, have athletes that are shaped to represent who they are. So we have a team in Indonesia is a good example. So it's called Inter Nusantara, which means a lot more to Indonesians than it probably means to us.
Yeah.
But it's shaped around what fandom means in that country. So we connected with podcasts over there and content creators over there who talk about this on a week by week, match by match kind of basis. Talk about selecting the teams, talk about, okay, we've got this game coming up, let's train this player. Like, that is what happens.
Yeah.
So what we want to give them is give fans all around the world the opportunity to have heroes that look like them. So if you're from India, the biggest name in Indian football is a guy called Sunil Chhetri. So he's a storied guy. He's getting right to the end of his career at the moment, but doing really well still. Goal scorer, but never played Premier League kind of level. Never played Serie A, La Liga, never played at those top levels, and probably not even the level below that. But he's the best Indian player that there ever was. Mm. And so he's a hero there. He's got millions of followers on Instagram because people really care.
Yeah.
There's a guy, Indonesian guy at the moment, young guy, I think he's 19 or 20, called Elkan Bagot, who plays for Ipswich Town. He's actually on loan somewhere else, on loan at Oxford or something like that at the moment. He's the big name Indonesian footballer at the moment. He's the great white hope. And so he plays for Ipswich Town. He's got a million followers on Instagram.
Yeah.
Now, again, not because of his objective ability compared to everyone else, but because of what he represents to fans all around the world, and particularly for him, Southeast Asian fans, to say, let's have a guy like, this is the guy, for this guy could be it, this will be everything to us. I was with the Bundesliga and some Bundesliga teams in Singapore relatively recently, and they were saying, if you could just sign someone from these markets, none of us would have to come to work anymore. Like, yeah. Because if Bayern Munich signed a young Indonesian kid, all of their matches would be watched by a million more people comfortably, mm-hmm. right? And so that model of giving them something they can look up to is a really big part of the connector here,
mm-hmm.
of how do we create something that fans mm-hmm. all around the world want to connect with and want to engage with on a regular basis.
Yeah, and it really says something about the reasons of engaging in sport. I mean, I have to confess to you, I'm not a big fan of football. I think that's why I got kicked out of the UK and live in Australia now. but my family were all Gunners. They followed Arsenal. My uncle, and I was one of the only sort of boys in the family growing up, with my sisters, cousins, all girls, etc.
Yeah.
He took me to a game, and it wasn't the goal scoring or the players. It was actually the community of having something to celebrate with my uncle, quality time. And I found that really interesting at the time. That's just another dimension of why people care about that stuff.
Mm.
Going to the pub, having that, you know, connected experience. But to your point as well, people from different regions having that connect, not on a team level, but on an individual player level.
Yes,
that's super fascinating.
And maybe to that point, maybe the worst audience for us here is that UK fan who has the Premier League on their doorstep, mm. who can go to a game at a moment's notice. I was talking to a very, very senior guy at one of the Premier League teams recently, and he was taking his time to get his head around it. And he was saying, I just don't get it. Like, why would my son, who can walk into any Premier League football stadium, watch any match at a moment's notice, be engaged around something like this? And you know, I think that there are angles in which he can be, but he's probably our worst customer because that kid, his dad works for a Premier League football team. He can get tickets to any game he wants to go to. He travels to every match. He's got access to go to the training ground and hang out with players and all this kind of stuff. But yeah, he's not the same as a 12-year-old who lives in Bangalore, lives in Manila, where they're not only distance away, they're time zones away from matches. So the matches are all terrible times for them. They can't watch the live matches, so they don't engage with it in that kind of way. So that they're limited in their ability to have that product served up to them in a way which even as it was designed.
Yeah, right. So that covered a lot, and thank you, that covered a lot of the fandom. But I also know there's the flip side to your business. I wonder if you could speak a bit more and kind of unpack that a bit and run through things like, you know, your celebrity sponsors, charity partnerships, brand opportunities, because that's what I found really fascinating as well.
Yeah, so every sport that we spin up creates almost infinite inventory when we create a new sport. So when we create a sport, and so football's our first one, but there'll be others around the corner, it creates the opportunity for us to create new teams, to create athletes. Those teams will then have shirts that need to be branded and then can be sold, and those teams will play in stadiums normally.
And those are both physical shirts and potentially digital.
Yeah,
I've seen some of that.
Yeah,
I'm still waiting for that South London partnership. I'm excited.
Got to get that
order in. They look fantastic.
Love that. Yeah. So yeah, I think that it spins up all of this content for us. And so think of a team in our ecosystem the same as you would think of any football team. So a team that plays in a European league has value. They have opportunity to bring brand partners in. They have stadium sponsors, all those things, as I mentioned. What we've done is we've said, we want to take the same approach. So every team that we create is a team that we can sell to someone who says, we understand this. We understand owning a team in this ecosystem has a greater than $0 value.
Hmm.
What that value is, we have to work out with them and see if they're the right partner to bring in. But then they put brands on the front of the shirts and on the sleeves, and they can sell the apparel. They can put names on all the kind of things that Manchester United would. If Manchester United has an official airline partner, well, why couldn't these guys have an official airline partner? We integrate in the same kind of way. So ambassadors was a big part of building the equity in the clubs. So us being able to say people like Naomi Osaka, Nick Kyrgios, Chris Smalling, Patrice Evra, Kamara Usman, Steve Smith, those kind of people are all ambassadors of teams across this league. It gives them more of an angle and more of a purpose. So for a young fan in Lagos, like Nigeria, they would look at a team and say, like, okay, new team, new league. Okay, the Nigeria team is represented as one of the 12 teams across this competition. I like that. We can compete. We can win and beat the establishment. I like that. Players kind of live here, notionally live here, and we've got more Nigerian players playing. I like that. I can see this. Oh, and the team is co-owned by Kamara Usman and a guy called Williams Uchemba and a guy called Rotimi. And it gives us this kind of whole angle around the purpose and the intent of the team. The team then has a charitable partner. So a partner that is in market that gets younger kids playing football and helps sponsor matches and gets equipment out to kids who need it. So when we're designing these teams, we want to design them kind of in the image of a young fan in those markets. So what are the issues that matter to these young people? So maybe a good one here is Argentina. So we put the team in Buenos Aires. It was all about creating something that was reflective of the youth. There's a big kind of youth rebellion happening at the moment of young people in Argentina because they kind of feel absolutely helpless. Their currency just fluctuates so wildly that there's kind of no point saving money ever, and so it's hard to save for a future because you don't know what that's going to look like. You know, in a week your savings might have cut in half or in quarter, like worse and worse and worse. Just happens all the time. And so they're looking for something that they can say, this is part of our story, this is something that stands up for us and represents us, and the players talk out about these things and become representative, where players in the physical world might be scared to do that and might be worried about their own kind of image if they stood up and said, actually, government's doing the wrong thing, this is not cool, our players will stand up and say those things. So, yeah, it's about, think of the teams as being the same as any other sporting team, where they have value, they have structure, and we can build all that together. It just lives digitally. We just don't have physical stadia that they have to play in.
Yeah, right. And I think you've kind of touched on one of my next questions. So with the rise of AI personalities, I mean, we've seen K-pop, we've seen Instagram influencers, and here we've got athletes, how you see the role of them playing in the future. And you've kind of touched on that. So I might ask a slightly different question in that, the narrative side.
Yeah.
Because, again, where does that come from? So if a player has a certain opinion or is speaking out or is fighting for a cause, where does that come from? Who writes that? Have you got a team of 1,000 people writing scripts and soap operas? How's that work?
I wish we had 1,000 people. It's a narrow team. Yeah, ultimately, we see each of our athletes as two things. One is they are a gateway to a new type of fan, a new audience out there. So it could be we have an Indian player who will appeal more to these fans across India. We have a Vietnamese player who appeal to these fans across Vietnam, for instance. At the same time, though, those players have quite complex personalities that are hidden. They're kind of part of their coding, let's say. And based on who they are, who they're hard-coded to be, different stories will come out about them and related to them. So we've got a very smart data science team that really helps with this stuff and means that we don't have to have 1,000 people building all this out. But essentially the way we approach it is all of the athletes have personality traits around impulsiveness and how kind of fiery they are in certain situations and how diligently they talk about things and think about things and relate to themselves, relate to relationships they have, how they rank from a mental health perspective. Like all of these kind of areas are mapped out as a starting point for all these athletes. And then they go on journeys. And so there's relationship journeys with other players, relationship journeys with their loved ones, relationship journeys with their families, relationship journeys with the manager. Like there's thousands and thousands of journeys that everybody's on. And the good thing about this stuff is we can just scale it. It's scalable at our end. So we know that athletes are capable of amazing things. So you see Marcus Rashford and everything he's done in the UK with getting young kids to be fed. All the stuff that you see LeBron doing away from his, like with his schooling stuff that he works on, brilliant, brilliant things. We also know that athletes are capable of terrible things. Mm. And so it doesn't take a long time before the next drug story comes out around players, drug use, drug dealing, whatever it might be, sexual assault allegations come up way frequently than anyone would like in sport, which I think talks to a power imbalance and all these kind of things.
Mm.
There's specific examples out there of Michael Vick, the NFL quarterback who ran a dogfighting ring, and that came out at one point a few years ago. So we know that while athletes are capable of brilliant things, we know they're capable of terrible things as well. What we get to do is we get to set the guide rails. So we get to look at that and say, what stories do we want to live in this world and what stories do we not want to live in this world? So we have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of possible stories that can hit anyone at any point in time based on their personalities, where they are on their certain journeys and with relation to relationships and mental health and career development and all these kind of things. And we then land stories that have complexities built into them from the list of stories against the players. So it'll just hit us. So a story will just come out of the engine and we just have to deal with it. Okay. So that story will come out and say, this footballer has punched this teammate. And so our job then is to say that's on record, built into the record of the league. We have to bring this story out. This is the time frame that we have to bring it out. This is the severity of it. Okay, now the kind of, we'll say like script writing element takes over, where we then say, what is the most logical way to bring this out for these, given we know these two players? And so it all rolls that way. And the stories can be, it doesn't have to be something as crazy as some teammate punches another teammate in the face. It could be someone gets married, someone gets engaged, someone breaks up with a partner. It could be really anything. Everything that you've ever considered as a story that happens in sport, we have it. We have it as a list of, within the list of hundreds and hundreds of stories that comes out. We add the art to it, and we also put guardrails so that we don't have the incredibly extreme stories that we just think are demonstrably not a good thing to tackle at this stage.
Man, there's so much there. These are narratives on and off the pitch.
Yeah.
So outside of just a digital, you know, football league, there's every character's got their backstory. That's fascinating. And also opens up the world. And as you said, the opportunities, the partnerships, everything we discussed earlier. The second, it's fascinating to hear you're kind of reactive in a good way to the AI model. So generating, hey, here's a curveball. This is what just happened. You're like, oh, wow. Okay. So it kind of keeps you on your toes, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
But third, and again, this is the parameter thing, if I understand you right, is, well, the model spat out something a bit too spicy. Let's bring it back a bit, or we don't think we should be going there. So you've got a level of control around not getting too sensitive, again, which could disrupt other things we spoke about earlier. So, wow, my mind's just kind of like grasping that, and that's fascinating. And how then do you tackle things like political topics? How do you ensure that, you know, you're not leaning too far left, right, centered, you're tiptoeing around how does that work? How do you ensure you get a diversity of ideas and represent them in a I don't know, respectful way, let's say?
Yeah, the core of our team is based in Melbourne, and I think we know that we're probably all quite left-leaning kind of suburbs as well. And so our job is to say, how do we create something which is not just like the left-leaning football league or the left-leaning cricket league or whatever else, but create something which is much more reflective of society. And so it's a challenge in that there are certain angles that we get to take, and that we need to make sure that we don't just take a specific set of political stances. So one of the good things is we can have players that stand up and will say something about the war in Ukraine, for instance. A Russian player could stand up and have something to say about that. At the same time, we don't want to trivialize things. And so we don't want to make it so we're just throwing stuff out there all the time. It just feels like we're kind of pointing up, just saying, oh, like everyone else should talk up. But what we have the opportunity to do is we have the opportunity to create athletes that will do things differently and will stand up for what they believe in, because they're not going to get knocked on their door and told by some politician that they have to stop.
Yeah,
maybe we will. But I think there are so many issues in sport, in life at the moment, that people are scared to talk about, and we do need to tread carefully. And I would say that we don't have the full answer there, because there are certain things that, you know, I think looking at gun control in the US as an example, we can't all have all of our athletes be completely on one side saying we should ban these types of weapons and this and this and this should happen. We need to have the people on the other side. And I think that the most healthy way that we can approach this is have discourse and not just have it kind of wash up always that the quote unquote good guys in the eyes of a team of people in Melbourne think is that is the right answer that should come up. And so everybody then just hugged and we all just got on with playing football. That's just going to make a mockery of the whole thing.
Yeah.
So I think we take that with the heavy regard that it deserves, that we can't just say we're just going to lean and everyone's going to be perfect and we're all just going to go down that path. It's a minefield, and one that we will work with and continue to work around. But I think that what the advantage that we have is we can have players that take strong positions. We have people on the ground in key markets that we're in physically. And so it's really useful when someone in Indonesia will say, the young people are feeling these things. It would be a good thing for this player to take this stance about the fact that the government didn't do a full inquiry into this stadium collapse that happened, and it was a pretty bad thing. We can trust in those and say, we're happy for players individually to take stances. We use players in that way. there might be other players that don't talk about something or that do talk about something on the other way and say, no, I think that they did all right, or they've handled it this way, or I believe in this side, or I think this is positive. And so, well, I think we have to use local knowledge is kind of the big answer to that to make sure that what we're doing doesn't trivialize it and doesn't create this like left-leaning football league.
Yeah, there's a lot to consider there. And what you've just spoke to is, let's say, the human side of it. Moving on to my next questions, I'm very interested, considering this is an AI model, how do you think about and approach AI ethics and bias in AI? So you've described a lot of the challenges you face from the model spits out the scenario as an example. How does that then influence the way you think about bias in AI? And then the second question to that is, how do you build, because we're talking about gaming, we're talking about football, people win, people lose, people are invested in this. How do you build a trustworthy platform where fans can, build trust, therefore you're able to build loyalty? And interest in your thoughts there.
Yeah, trust is probably the biggest issue that we have in terms of how our engines work and how we operate on a rolling basis. We know we're not screwing with it, but we need to have a way to bring that for people to be able to see that that's not being screwed with. Now, there's two ways we can do that. One is we publish everything to the blockchain and we just say that there is a single immutable record that shows exactly what happened here. 99.99% of people are not going to really know how to go and look that up or check it out, but enough people will do that that gives us the ability to say, trust it. The second is you can go down like an audit process and get one of the big four accounting firms to just come in and put their name to it and say, yes, we're doing this in the right way and we're a part of this. Either or, I think it's going to depend on just the evolution and where the right business where the business goes. We probably see it that there's a blend of those two models. The other issue of bias in AI, I mean, I think the way that we use AI is pretty, like that, it's pretty constrained in that we don't look at it and say, tell me a full story, like go here and do these things, design me the perfect athlete. Like we don't approach it in those ways, because you say design me the perfect athlete and then there's four young, good-looking white women on the screen that have been created by some image tool. We don't trust it in that way. Now, do we create a world where our players are probably better looking than the average person on the street? Probably, because that's just part of what we are able to do. And that's probably something that we need to keep in our consideration set as we go forward, is how do we create achievability and realism? And I think that when you look at the way that younger people are using these technologies at the moment, one reason that I really like the way that Roblox simplifies things and kids can go in there and create avatars of themselves. If I'm in a wheelchair, it doesn't mean I have to be in a wheelchair in Roblox. If I've got an amputated left hand, it doesn't mean I have to have an amputated left hand in Roblox. It creates this ability for what's in someone's imagination and mind and creativity reflects them probably better than the physical vehicle that they live in on a daily basis. So I think that there's something in that story which I really like, of the ability of people to reflect themselves in our world in a positive way, where even if you kind of ignore the visuals of our players, one thing we really like is maybe the best manager in our league will end up being a 47-year-old mum from Finland. Maybe she just gets it. She's smart. She's intuitive. She gets it.
The Ted Lasso story. Yeah.
But she's never going to be the manager of Liverpool, right? She's not going to. There's just not that pathway there. But maybe there's something in our world where we create this vehicle, this structure that says it's not about your track record as a footballer, your physical output. Like, it's not about that. It's about us creating an ecosystem that allows you to feel connected in and you to feel as strong as you are. And not have this kind of filter put on what you do because you're a 47-year-old Finnish woman from Finland. The same as when we think about teams from Indonesia and from India, again, like the view often in the terraces is, oh, there's a bunch of Indian fans in the stadium at the Emirates. They must be tourists. Look at all those plastics taking away tickets from real fans. Like, who's to say they're not real fans? And so who's to say they're not as big a football fan or a bigger Arsenal fan as you? You just live near the stadium. That's just lucky for you. Mm. In our world, we try to take football out and create this reflective model where we have these players running around that maybe creates a more of a culture of respect across geographies and nationalities, because yep, you conceded a goal and the Indian guy scored against you. That's just how it is. And even in the future, you've conceded a goal and it's a young woman who scored against you.
Mm.
I like that as a kind of future angle.
And that's a really good point, which leads to another question I had. So with the growth and adoption of female sports, do you get challenged in terms of like the diversity there? And I think for our conversation so far, you've already kind of alluded that while the male league, One Future Football, is here, it sounds like there's a few things brewing. I don't know if you can,
yeah,
what you can share.
Yeah, we think of it as, ultimately, we'd love this to be a co-ed league. So nowhere else can you have a co-ed league that exists in the football sense at the top level of football. We see a model and an opportunity for us to say, what if this team just signed three players out of the academy or out of the draft and just so happens that two of them were young women? It's not impossible, right? It doesn't affect anyone in a negative way that this is ridiculous. I think why we've started with all male players at the moment to start with is it's given us the opportunity to learn a lot more about every market around the world and how they engage with this. Because unfortunately, the world isn't just what it looks like out of your door when you live in Sydney or Melbourne or Brisbane or Perth or Adelaide. We have to be cognizant of the world is very different in different parts of the world. And maybe someone just couldn't get over this at the start if there was a young girl who scored and they lost the match. And then it's like, well, this is rubbish. This doesn't make any sense to me. So,
First, there's a bit of a gap in terms of change the way people think that a virtual league could be engaging in something meaningful.
Yeah.
So that's the first hurdle.
Yeah.
But then so those sort of people that need to get over that hurdle, you're saying, let's take them, handhold them step by step.
It's a journey, right?
Yeah.
Have we got support to bring in young women into this? Absolutely. The support is there. The support from the brands, from the clubs that we're talking to about owning teams, it's there. We're just treading it out carefully, but I'd say almost every conversation we have with a sport, with a new sport, includes conversation of, is this men only? Can it be co-ed? How does that work? So that's a good thing.
Yeah, and that's what influences that? So if you look at all the different sports, I know you've got some famous tennis players, footballers, et cetera, et cetera. What's influencing, or how do you approach, what the next sport is, or gender, or whatever the case may be? Is it a matter of addressable market? Is it influence of the celebrities involved? How do you think about that?
Really, it's about who we're going to do this with. And so for us, it's about, we've done One Future Football as so far on our own, we just launched all from the start. We run everything. We do everything. We've got a model of, we can build this with other rights holders in sport around the world. And so it will be led by those conversations. Who's the right partner to bring this to the world? Who's the right partner to give this opportunity for more scale? Who's the right partner to give this, bring the right commercial partners into it? So yeah, we're on the verge, I'd say, with a few. And so which one there is that lands first, I'm not sure, but our aim is to have 20 sports up in 3 years' time. And so do this seriously and have the whole ecosystem of virtual sports supporting stadium sports. So if you're Wimbledon, they play for 2 weeks of the year and 50 weeks they're off, we fill those other weeks. If you're the Formula One, you race for, I'm going to get this wrong, but 24-ish Sundays a year. For all the rest of the days of the week, there's a bit of warm-up and practice and stuff. But the most of the week and most of the year, they're not racing. So could you create a virtual Formula One league that happens, that doesn't have to wait for that serendipitous moment of, wow, we have this perfect driver who comes from this country. We can design that. You know, so if you started a Formula One virtual league tomorrow, you'd have a driver from North America, like USA. You'd have someone from India open up that market. You'd have a Chinese driver open up that market. So you create this, and you'd better put races in places that would be hard to do. So the task...
The moon. I want the moon.
Right, you could, right? But the thing is, that maybe the moon doesn't have a tourist body that wants to pay us to put race there. But, you know, the job of getting the Vegas race up would have cost them $40, $50 million of planning to get it up, right? But we create a world where we can say, if you want to race in Madagascar, we can do that. You know, you want to race in Iceland, we can do that. You want to race in, like, down the streets of London, we can do that. So we create this ecosystem that allows people to spin things up with the right relevance and the right stories around it, and hopefully move quickly.
I want to shift gears now and just quickly talk from a technical lens, let's say. When I look at One Future Football, One Future Sports, many may immediately think, you know, and you even alluded to it, blockchain, NFT. I understand your platform's not on that. What made that decision? Why not ride that wave? What was your thoughts from a technical perspective?
So when we first started planning this, I think it was a part that was, yeah, these players can be NFTs, the shares can be NFTs, fans will be able to trade them, we'll do it this way. I think as we came into actually getting closer to launch, we felt that it was too hype cycle-y and it was coming off a bit at the time. It wasn't like crash time, but it was coming off a bit and it felt like, oh, look, there's probably a bit more money there in the short term, but we don't want to create this ecosystem where we've got young fans who are new to this that we're saying, okay, go create a wallet. And then once you've got a wallet, you need to fill it with this token. It's like, okay, you haven't got a token. Okay, you need to go to an exchange. You need to sign up to an exchange. It's a 12, 13, 14 step process to get someone new to buy an NFT in that kind of way. Now, there are simplified ways of doing it, which are kind of walletless and you obfuscate a lot of it. We've seen it. We are cool with it. But where it didn't help the user experience, we just didn't want to rush into it. I think there is still a model that can be relevant for us. We're probably looking for a bunch of the tech and I guess the UX of it, the user experience, to just simplify, to be better, to be easier, to be genuinely advantageous. You know, I've probably mentioned it 3 or 4 times now, but Roblox didn't put all their stuff on the chain. Everyone was saying at the time, oh, make everything NFT, make everything tradable, do this, and this. And they probably walked away from $100 million of extra revenue from doing that. But it's then not created this thing where, okay, well, now your things are only worth this and that item's only worth this. And now you've got to kind of burn all that because that doesn't really make sense to anybody anymore. So I think we wanted to focus on product rather than focusing on technology that didn't serve the product.
And from an AI agility perspective, another thing that I think's very prominent in news is just the rate of innovation in this space. How dependent are you, or how much of a risk is your own proprietary models? Is that what you're doubling down on, or is it more of a, oh, hey, we're going to look at the Microsoft, the OpenAIs, the Googles? How do you think about that in terms of how much should we invest and become unique in this sense, or use more foundational models and kind of fine tune them for our needs? Like, how do you think about that?
Yeah, great question. I think we've got a bunch of engines that we're building ourselves, which, you know, the buzzword now is AI. For us, it's the engines that we're building. Is there artificial learning in there? Yeah, there is. Is it just a step further than when it was the original machine learning models? Was it a step further than when it was big data? Like, it's all kind of, for us, it's just part of that journey of the development of the technology. So we think about, we've got a very smart data science team that's building what we need now. And so are we relying on that? Yes, but that's fine because we totally control it and own it. We've got a decent partnership in some areas of creating more like visual content with someone that we really like in this market. So that's working for us. I think there's no singular reliance that we'd say, like, if this platform fell over tomorrow, it would not be useful. If anything, we like the ability to be agile and to say, look, we can jump and move, and we do jump and move because the technology is evolving so quickly that we're just getting more and more interesting, useful tools that are popping up that we say, actually, we can use that one to help us with this thing now. Now we can use that one. Here's something else. Here's something else. Let's just keep on rolling and evolving, rolling and evolving. And I think that when you look at all the various uses of maybe image generational video AI stuff, we're probably one of the biggest beneficiaries of it from a business perspective. If you went back 24 months and said, go and build what you've built, it would look like garbage compared to what it looks like now. And so our ability to roll with that as it goes and just be the customer of those things is working for us, and we're happy with that for now.
Peter, this has been amazing. I think our quick chat turned into quite a long conversation, but yeah, that's been fantastic. No, it's fantastic. Thanks so much. I think there's so many other questions we could have, but yeah, respectful of your time. Want to make sure we're good there. So I think I've got a lot personally to kind of pick apart and digest, let's say. But in terms of my takeaways from the conversation so far, first and foremost, I love the fact that you're challenging the way people think. And that comes in three flavors. First, that inclusion piece. So what does a new wave of global fandom look like? And how AI personalities are becoming a new way into diverse markets. I found that super fascinating. The second flavor of that is ways of expressing yourself. So both the lean in, we spoke to a lot of the lean back experience, but the fact that you can train your players and strategize with other fans, there's more of a lean in part, which I thought was super fascinating. And also just questioning what quote unquote real engagement means. As you said, the lucky few get to go to the stadium, get to breathe in the air, get to feel what it's like to be there. But that's what, a percent of the overall fandom, let's say. So again, just really challenging that and what sport means in our lives, whether you can be there in person, let's say, or not. The next key takeaway for me, I think, is that rise of AI personalities and the importance of the ethical AI. And we touched on that. And again, fascinating to see for yourselves. It's two things. One, it's the model, what it spits out. But then two, what do you or do you not do with that? Which I found fascinating and a very interesting challenge for yourselves to kind of work through day to day. I wonder, is it like a scrum meeting every morning where, oh crap, this just happened. Look what the model spat out. We need
to... It happens like that. Yeah,
wow.
Because we don't know what's coming. We know the guardrails, so it's not going to say something
That
we're not genuinely comfortable with. But it can throw a curveball that's like, oh no, don't get that player injured. Don't get that player suspended because he's done these things.
Yeah.
You know, he's a star. There's not much we can do about it. We need to keep that credibility going, and the ability for us to create something that people can trust and rely on is crucial for it.
Yeah, and if it would be easy, it'd be boring. and I think the last key takeaway for myself is the business opportunities off the back of building such an engaging and broad ecosystem. And it really sounds like you're just scratching the surface. So again, really fascinating to see the types of brands, charities, and influencers and sports people you're working with. And I really look forward to seeing more in the future. So with that, for those listening, 1ff.com, 1futurefootball.com, and more to come.
Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.